Thank you, Lisa. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Keith versus Kroger.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Robertson will present arguments for the petitioner. Please reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Tony Robertson. I'm the attorney for Linda Keach, who's petitioner. This is a slip and fall case which gives this court an opportunity to finally unify the practice of submitting broad form questions. The present practice is that in trial courts, separate and distinct issues are still being submitted. 4 years ago, Linda Keach walked into the Kroger store in Grand Prairie. She slipped on what the jury found was an unreasonably dangerous and slippery spot. She fell, and she has not worked on a regular basis since that time.
Counsel, doesn't this case turn not so much on whether broad issues should be submitted with appropriate explanatory instructions about the standard by which the jury should be guided, but whether or not we will continue to require, as the restatement of torts does, a finding or a determination of unreasonable risk of harm based upon the condition of the premises in a premises liability case?
Justice Cornyn, I think that that is the last remaining question that this court has not spoken on, and that is in Corbin versus Safeway Stores, this court did say that the jury issue is whether or not unreasonable risk of harm ought to be submitted.
And we affirmed that in Hernandez versus Kroger Company, 1986.
Well, correct. Hernandez versus Kroger did affirm that, but it was decided before the 1988 amendment to Rule 277.
You think Rule 277 changed the substantive law of premises liability?
Well, I think it changed the way it's submitted when it ordered that, or when it mandated that in every case where it was feasible, that the trial judge ought to submit it broadly. And I think that if we look at the definition of unreasonable risk of harm, this court set out in that Sidenek versus, I can't pronounce the cow, Bayrother Associates. The definition of unreasonable risk of harm incorporated, apparently, the same issues or same concepts as proximate cause, so that if it's submitted separately now, I requested that it be submitted separately and got a finding on it in this case.
So you agree with the amicus that unreasonable risk of harm is subsumed in a proximate cause submission?
I do, Judge, and I like that word, subsumed. I don't use that in my daily language, but I agree that that is exactly what the proximate cause issue does. It encompasses the same issues as unreasonable risk of harm. And as in this case, it creates a bit of a conflict because you've got the jury finding, on the one hand, that there was an unreasonable risk of harm, which this court has said includes the concept of foreseeability, and then you've got them finding that they neither knew or should have known that there was a spot on the floor. I don't think those are necessarily mutually exclusive because our position is that the knowledge of the condition that's required to be found by the jury is the condition which includes what Corbin said that condition was, a method of operation, a course of conduct, which we've described as their negligent activity of spraying these products out of the aisles where the customers were anticipated to be.
The issue you requested and which was refused by the trial court was, did Kroger cause the slick spot to be on its premises? Is that correct?
We requested that in addition to the general or the broad form issue, and we requested that because our whole theory of the case was that they had negligently located their spraying operation out where they knew that customers were going to be.
Are you complaining, and how does that comply with the Rule 277 requirement of broad submission, a requested issue that says, did Kroger cause the slick spot to be on its premises?
It is an abundance of caution is all that was.
That was an alternative submission to the general negligence?
It was not an alternative. It was requested in addition to the general negligence issue. And it was requested for the purpose of determining, in the event that they caused it to be on their premises, at the time we tried this case, the pattern jury charge addition recommended, recommended that you submit these cases either by asking a about the third party's conduct in placing this on the floor and whether the Provost Mirror should have known about it, which was submitted, or it set out a series of issues which allowed the court to submit whether it's Provost created the condition and whether that was negligence not removing. So
I just want to be clear that you requested this issue that I just quoted and a general negligence issue, and you're complaining about the trial court's failure to submit both of those issues.
I'm complaining about the trial court's failure to either submit the general negligence issue, and if the court is going to retain a separate and distinct issue of premises cases, then I'm complaining about the failure to submit creation of the hazard by Croker.
Let's take that second
I don't need
part.
The creation issue if the court says that we submit this generally as we do other negligence cases. Pardon me, Justice.
Setting aside the broad submission for a moment, as to the specific issue, why didn't the issue that the trial court submitted give you this other question? In other words, what if reasonable under the law of negligence about saying that if somebody has caused something, they're strictly liable for it, whether or not they knew or should have known that it was put down, that they had placed it there?
Judge, the way I understand the reasonableness of holding them liable if they created the condition is that they're then, it's just like imputing knowledge to someone. We have a statute that says if you record a deed, the deed records is noticed to everyone. I read those cases as saying if you create the condition, you're charged with the knowledge, even in a circumstance where it's possible that, for instance, to use the analogy of my case, where if the plants are sprayed with a spray in a fashion where Kroger intentionally or carelessly just ignores whether or not anything accumulates on the floor, it's possible, I suppose, that they could not inspect, they could spray without checking, they could be so careless as to conduct this operation where they were foreseeable, and the jury found that it was foreseeable, that some injury would occur, and then just not check for anything being on the floor and do it inadvertently. If they inadvertently create the hazard, then if they create it, they're charged with the knowledge that it's on the floor, whether they have, that is actual knowledge because they have created it, even if they have not looked and seen it down there on the floor.
Can you cite the court in any case which upholds the point that you presented?
I thought the coffee case said that. And that's this court's opinion, which held that the platform on the floor was a creation of Woolworth stores, and that charge, I read coffee as saying that charged Woolworths with knowledge. I think the language was that they had actual knowledge of it if they created conditions.
You concede that the coffee case submitted the case to the jury, and the jury made findings on a charge substantially similar to the one submitted by the trial court in this case?
No.
Well, coffee was a turn on whether there was some evidence to support the jury's findings of liability, didn't it?
Well,
based on a judgment NOV?
I read Coffey to discuss what evidence supported the jury's finding that Woolworth created the condition and therefore had actual knowledge by reason of creating the condition. The thing that
but there's just I can see in some particular cases, leaving a platform on the floor, you could hardly have put it down there without, it almost subsumes negligence because it's big, it's not something that's accidental. But surely there are some cases where a store employee could simply drop something and it would or something could get on the floor and it would not be negligence not to notice it, so that there's an element of strict liability in taking this coffee case to its furthest extent, is there not?
Not to me, Judge, because I think you're right that certainly an employee could create something inadvertently by dropping it. Maybe that's a different situation than where they created. Coffee was a case where this court discussed the evidence about the employees having to stock these shelves and work around it, and it involved time and the lapse of time and a slowly created condition. Our case involved spraying some 50 plants over an entire day where this spot was not a small spot that was 3 or 4 feet across.
But you're, what the issue you're asking us to submit, or that you asked the trial court to submit, assumes that the condition could not be created without negligence. In other words, the trial court, it's kind of almost a res ipsa situation. If it was there and if it was created by an employee of the store, it has to be negligence because the jury is just not asked to pass on it.
The only thing that the finding of creation would have done would have satisfied the actual knowledge requirement. That's all. It wouldn't have found the negligence they had. Then we also requested the negligence issue in broad form, which would have resolved this case. In fact, it would have resolved this case without the submission of any issue on knowledge or a creation of the defect. It would have resolved the case in exactly the same way that an automobile case is resolved by submission of the general broad form negligence issue.
Did you have, excuse me for not remembering this, but did you have instructions that accompanied this broad form submission?
The instruction we had were the general negligence,
just the
definition,
general
negligence definition of proximate
cause. So in other words, getting back to your first argument, your argument, the 1988 rules amendment essentially swept away all the premises liability slip and fall law that we've been accumulating over the last 70 or 80 years.
Judge, if this court's opinions mean what they say, yes, that's my position. And the reason I say that is after a month before the Dallas Court of Appeals wrote this opinion, this court handed down the EB decision, Department of Human Services versus EB. You said to us out there trying these cases that here we'll tell you what it means in the rule when it says you submit these whenever it's feasible. What feasible means, that is in every case where it's capable of being accomplished. Now that to me says it swept away that procedure, not the substantive law. All of those
issues.
The
substantive law disappears if the jury's never instructed about it.
Well, I think they are instructed about it, Judge. That's what I thought Rule 277 did and EB did. The elements of unreasonable risk of harm are, I believe, contained in the proximate cause definition. It speaks in terms of foreseeability and the reasonable man standard. Those issues are adequately charged, I think, under the proximate cause definitions and the definitions of negligence.
Is it your contention that harmful error is always shown when the trial court submits less than a broad form submission?
Judge, it bothers me to make that argument because I think that there has to be some discretion in the submission of these cases. But on the point of whether to submit broad form issues where it's feasible, and this is a case where the Court of Appeals, at least, has said to us that it was feasible. They said the trial judge could have submitted a broad form issue, but he did not use his discretion.
So we have to address the issue then whether your requested issue was in substantially correct form in order to preserve the error?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think that these cases, if you read the language of the cases that this court has given to the lawyers down in the trenches, we're sitting out there reading these cases saying, Judge, when you get to the charge conference, well, what do we submit? We've got a line of cases that says in Lemus against Montez, we've repeatedly held that it's feasible to submit these issues, or they should be submitted when language was if that's the proper method for submission to the jury. Then we amend the rule. This court amends the rule to say to do it whenever feasible. Then after amending the rule, the court writes an opinion about what is feasible and says in every case where it's capable of being accomplished. Now, when we're sitting down there reading your opinions, trying to decide what to submit to the court, we may be overly cautious, as I was, in submitting this unreasonably dangerous issue. We may be overly cautious in submitting the issues about creation, but all we needed and the error was in not submitting it broadly.
Just so I can be sure and understand, are you saying or are you not saying that broad submission, the requirement to submit an issue broadly wherever feasible, does or does not change the substantive law of premises liability?
Does not change the substantive law of premises liability.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian Brandstetter will represent the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Robertson. I have Mr. Rob Roby with me today. He tried this lawsuit with me. Your Honors, this case has kind of taken a strange twist, I think. I think that a lot of the questioning that was talked about and a lot of the argument with Mr. Robertson wasn't really even before the trial court and probably really isn't an issue in this case and probably wasn't even raised until the amicus brief was filed. When the court looks at the objections to the charge and the position that Mr. Robertson took at the trial court, his position was twofold, which was also the position that he basically took in his brief before this court and in the brief before the Court of Appeals. And that was, first of all, the proposition that if Kroger or any premises owner creates a condition, they're charged with knowledge of it as a matter of law. That was his first one. Second was that it was a not a condition, not a premises condition case, but rather an activity case. And now he's up here telling this court, and I don't think that it's before this court in this case, that this court should change premises liability law. He's talked about that and that the amendment to Rule 277 changed the substantive laws put forth under Corbin. I'm prepared to argue that. I'm prepared to meet any questions the court has with regard to that, but I don't really think it's before the court in this case. Basically, Mr. Robertson's argument, and it wasn't really addressed, I'll address it briefly because it's in the briefs, but with regard to an activity versus a condition, and that was his basis for arguing to the trial court that a general negligence issue should be submitted, because if they created it, it's an activity, there's no new or should have known element. And that's another thing that I think the court needs to realize is that there are a lot of questions, a lot of argument about unreasonably dangerous condition and all of that. The jury found an unreasonably dangerous condition. I don't think that's before the court. The key to this case is the new or should have known element under the Corbin case. And that's where, that's what the judgment against the plaintiff is based on in this case, is the jury's failure to find that Kroger knew or should have known of the unreasonably dangerous condition. And that's what the basis for this whole case is. With regard to the activity versus condition case, I think the Supreme Court cases are clear in this regard, that for a case to be an activity case, someone actually has to be injured by the activity itself. The case decided by Mr. Robertson involved someone who was struck by a truck, another person who was injured by a tractor, and another person who was injured during a construction type operation where a cable broke and someone was injured by the cable. Those are all cases where the activity itself injured the person.
How about the coffee case?
The coffee case, Your Honor, I think you got to take a big step and a big jump to get to from the coffee case to the position that Mr. Robertson's taking today. The coffee case, and it's important to remember also that most of these cases we're looking at are either instructed verdict cases, directed verdict cases, or they're appealing after a judgment, NOV, something like that. In the coffee case, what the court looked at was to see whether there was sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that Woolworths knew or should have known of the condition. And the court stated they put it there, therefore a jury could infer from that that they knew about it. Therefore, there was sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict. The court in the coffee case never even comes close to saying because they put it there, they're charged with knowledge as a matter of law. The other cases in that regard cited by Mr. Robertson, I would point out to the court, as I did in my brief, that those cases, it's basically all dicta in those cases. The new or should have known element is not before the courts in those cases. And as an old law professor once told me, you need to follow those cases back. If they say something you don't agree with, follow them back and see where it came from. Well, I follow those cases back to a case that I've cited in my brief. Which is the... cited in my brief, Your Honor, I don't have it right here before me.
The Adair case?
Pardon me?
The Adair case?
The Adair case. Thank you, Justice Cornyn. Cited it back to that case, which again was a case just like the coffee case, where the court was on appeal examining the sufficiency of the evidence. And basically what it boils down to is what the courts are saying is that there's three different categories of proof which a plaintiff can use to establish the new or should have known element. They can either show that the defendant knew it was there, they should have known it was there, or that they put it there. And what the courts are saying there is that those are the types of evidence that if it's before the jury will support a yes finding to the jury issue, did they know about it or should they have known about it?
Well, a general negligence submission, Linus Montez type of submission, preserve the premises liability law in this?
It can, Your Honor, with proper instructions. I think that it's possible, and that's where I think the trial lawyers and the trial courts probably may be looking for some guidance from this court with regard to how to do that. You can preserve premises liability law. In fact, I've had it done on some premises liability cases that I've tried, where the trial court has submitted an instruction somewhat along these lines. Negligence as it relates to an owner or occupier means the failure to reduce or eliminate the risk of harm created by an unreasonably dangerous condition which the owner or occupier knew about or should have known about. And with that instruction, you still retain the elements of a traditional slip and fall premises liability case, and you can still comply with the general submission requirements under the rule. Now, in this case, they were submitted separately. I fail to see how anybody can take the position that that is harmful error in a case such as this. I fail to see how anyone can take the position that that caused or reasonably did cause the rendition of an improper judgment at the trial court. And if there is any conflict in how premises liability cases should be submitted, if there is any confusion, I think that confusion would only be, do you submit them in the separate issues, such as was done in this case, or do you submit a question, whose negligence, if any, proximately caused the occurrence in question, and have a general negligence definition for the plaintiff, if contributory or comparative fault to that issue, and have an issue or an instruction, as I've set forth here, with regard to the premises, to the premises owner.
Well, given the tradition of submitting them separately, how would we ever move the trial courts to submit them generally if it's not treated as harmful error?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a situation where you can only advise them in opinions such as this one, that this is the way we would prefer to have it done. Again, it's set forth in the rule. There's many avenues. The Texas law is full of examples where the courts say, well, it's error, don't do it anymore, but in this case it's harmless. And we would prefer that you didn't take a certain position or do a certain thing at the trial court level, but it was harmless.
The rule you're basically arguing then would apply in automobile litigation or any other case where the trial court chose to submit it separately, never harmful error.
I think that's true, Your Honor.
Just good practice.
I think it's just better practice to do it generally, and this court has recognized that. But I fail to see how a petitioner, as in this case, can meet their burden of proof to show harmful error in a situation like this.
If you could conceivably do that, is that waived when the petitioner has also requested bifurcated issues?
Well, I think it would be waived. I think it would also be waived, Your Honor, by an examination of the objections, not only an examination of the requested charge that Mr. Roberts had submitted, but also an examination of the objections to the court's charge, where he never takes the position that Rule 277 Amendment changed premises liability law, and that these should just be submitted under general negligence instructions and general broad negligence submission. Again, his two-part argument before the trial court was, again, they're charged with knowledge of it as a matter of law, and second, it was an activity rather than a premises defect, and therefore you don't need the new or should have known element.
Is it your position that pattern jury charge section 61.03 is an incorrect statement of the
law? Yes, Your Honor, it is. And in fact, I wanted to address that because Mr. Posa sent in the amicus brief. One of my partners is also on the pattern jury charge committee, and again, this is not before the record of this court, but it's my understanding that the pattern jury charge committee is rethinking that and is basically waiting for some guidance from this court. I think it's incorrect, Your Honor. I think their reliance on the Parker versus Highland Park case, as set forth in the amicus brief, is misplaced. As the court knows, the Parker versus Highland Park case did away with the no-duty doctrine. And there's a quote from the Highland Park case that says, these cases are just simple negligence cases. And the pattern jury charge committee took that quote and, in my opinion, went a step too far, misconstrued it, and said that all we need is the general negligence definition. In that regard, I would refer the court to the Corbin case, where again, at page 295 of the Corbin versus Safeway case, this court says, in subsequent cases, we emphasized that an invitee suit against a store owner is a simple negligence action. But then this court goes on further, and referring to the restatement, Section 343 simply tailors the traditional test of the conduct of a reasonably prudent person to a specific category of defendants, namely premises occupiers. So even in the Corbin case, while this court still recognized the general proposition that a premises liability case is a simple negligence case, they still realized the traditional problems with being a premises owner and still realized that the restatement is correct, that a premises owner still has to be found to have either known or should have known through reasonable diligence about an unreasonably dangerous condition in order to impose liability on that premises owner.
Well, respecting your argument in that regard, nevertheless, to rule for you, don't we have to repudiate the Pattern Jury Charge Committee on this issue?
I think you'd have to say that the proposed issue by the Pattern Jury Charge is not correct.
I think so.
I think you'd have to say that their submission is incorrect. It's also interesting to me to note in that regard that the Pattern Jury Charge Committee, when you turn the page and they talk about submission of a licensee case, still has instructions and still sets out the different instructions regarding the licensee with where they have to prove actual knowledge on the part of the premises occupier in order to sustain liability in a licensee situation.
Well, now, Parker did not report to abandon categories for premises liability in all types of situations.
No, Your Honor. That's exactly my point, Your Honor. I think the Pattern Jury Charge Committee took a one-sentence line out of the Parker case that said premises liability cases should be tried on simple negligence principles. And what the court meant there was, we're going to do away with no duty. We're going to do away with assumption of the risk. We're going to do away with all these other old defenses, and it's just going to be premises occupier's negligence versus plaintiff's negligence. And that court never went on to say that you take away the traditional elements or you do away or dispense with the traditional elements of the slip and fall case. And this court has never said that. Even after a lot of the cases where this court said things should be submitted generally, after the Lemos versus the Lemos case, this court, through Corbin and the Hernandez case, has still always said these are the elements of the premises liability case. One, an unreasonably dangerous condition. Two, that the occupier knew about or should have known about. And three, that they were negligent in either failing to reduce or eliminate the risk. And this court has never said anything other than that. That is the law in the state of Texas. That is still the law in the state of Texas. And there was no harm for the trial court to submit it the way the trial court did. In that regard, I point out to the court that I think it's the burden of Mr. Robertson and his teach in this case to establish to this court not that the charge of the court could have been submitted in another way or might have been submitted in another way. His burden is to show that the submission by the court in this case was improper, and I don't think he can meet that burden. It's also his burden to show that the submission the way it was submitted was harmful and was reasonably calculated to result in the rendition of an improper judgment. And I don't think that burden has been met in this case either.
Counsel, your side, I believe you, unless I heard you wrong, you said Section 61.03, the Pattern Jury Charge, but I think the one you're referring to, and I just want to clarify, is the premises liability where the plaintiff is an invitee, 66.04, is that right?
There may be a miscite, right, but that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Where in the Pattern Jury Charge it says you submit it with a general negligence question and you use the traditional standard general negligence instruction for the definition of negligence.
Well,
without any further instruction.
The PJC under 66.04, after discussing the Corbin case of the requirement of an unreasonable risk of harm, it says the committee expresses no opinion on whether this issue should be presented to the jury in the form of an instruction or as a separate question. So my reading of this would say that it's perhaps as opposed to us having to disapprove what the PJC committee said would be to clarify that perhaps according to your argument that some instruction on unreasonable risk of harm is necessary.
Thank you for pointing that out, Your Honor. And in response to Justice Doggett, the reason I said that we should that I would disagree or that this court may have to say that they're incorrect is because although in the comments they say we don't express an opinion on it, when it substance of the issue and says what definition of negligence to use, I believe it refers back to just the general negligence definition. And so that's why I say that I think it's incorrect and why I think that this court should know, because there is, I've received a number of phone calls from people that are interested in this, and I think it's an area that a lot of people are interested in, and although I don't think that it's before this court, based on the arguments and the submissions that Mr. Robertson requested at the trial court, it's something that might ought to be addressed by this court.
Can Parker again, be completely right and Corbin and Hernandez also be right? Can those be can Parker, Corbin, and Hernandez all be completely correct?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Again, I think the Parker, you're talking about Parker versus Highland Park?
Yeah.
Again, Your Honor, I think it's clear from reading that case that the court, I don't think the court back then was thinking ahead to a general submission like we have now. There the court was doing away with the no-duty doctrine, and a reading of the case shows that the court goes into great detail to go back about the reasons why the no-duty doctrine should be abolished. Goes back to the abolition of assumption of the risk and talks about these things as far as we ought to just compare each side's negligence. And the Parker versus Highland Park case never went so far as to say that we're changing the rules with regard to establishing liability for a premises occupier. And no Texas Supreme Court case that I know of has ever gone forward and said that. And as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see from the cases that have come down, Corbin is still the law, and Hernandez versus Kroger is still the law. And the way the case was submitted to the jury in this case, followed the exact elements that set forth in Corbin and Hernandez. And I fail to see how that could be harmful error in a case such as this, even if it could have been submitted generally with instructions regarding knew or should have known, unreasonably dangerous condition, and things like that. The court has no further questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Please, court. I'd like to address Justice Phillips's comment that a case where, as you said, a bifurcated request was made to the trial judge for submission of issues would be one where you could state a preference for a specific type of submission without reversing harmful error. Judge, it would be a bitter pill for us down there in these charge conferences if we take Corbin, which has a statement in it that you that sounds like you submit a question about unreasonable dangerous condition, and you take the existing pattern jury charge recommendations with their logic and citations that request either a question about did the defendant create the condition or did he know or should he have known that it was there, and have the practitioners, in an effort to cover all the bases, make the request in pleadings, in the request of the court, in the objections, specifically pointing out that we're requesting a general, a broad form submission, and then add those two issues as a request, and have the court then get to this point and say it was error to submit it that way, but we can
did you preserve an objection at the trial court level that it would be error to submit a bifurcated set of issues here because it should be submitted on a general charge?
Our request to the trial judge was that it was error to submit any kind of a negligence question which did not include our negligent activity request, and we requested in substantially correct form a broad form negligence issue.
I did not make the objection to the court that
it was error to submit both the created question, and the reason I didn't make that objection, I requested it because it would be just surplusage if I got the findings on the broad form negligence issue, and I consider it to be surplusage in this court. No harm, it's an additional burden for the plaintiff, and as I say, it would be a bitter pill for us to follow several what appear to the practitioners to be somewhat conflicting instructions from this court, and then have it held that this was not harmful error to not submit it in broad form in this case because we didn't object to the bifurcated. I don't call it bifurcated, but
multiple issues.
Multiple, yes, sir. Thank you. I'd also like to adjust.
I understand, Mr. Robertson, by broad form, do you mean an issue, the only instructions under which are negligence and proximate cause?
That's what I mean, Judge.
Yes. And you don't mean a broad form which says, is the defendant liable, and then has instructions which include, for example, To answer this question, yes, you must find by preponderance of the evidence that Kroger knew or in the exercise of ordinary care should have known that the slippery spot was on the floor. That's not what you mean by broad form.
Absolutely not.
No.
Broad form, I mean, is the similar to the pattern jury charges request for whose negligence, if any, was proximate cause of the occurrence with the definitions of proximate cause and negligence.
And only those definitions.
I say only those definitions in the invitee case, the cause of Cytonec. I read Cytonec to have a definition of unreasonably dangerous condition which uses the same elements that are already submitted in negligence and proximate cause definition. For that reason, I do not request, and I think that it would not be appropriate to have an additional question or instruction on unreasonably dangerous condition. However, I can tell you that I can live with an opinion that said you do submit generally and you include an instruction on unreasonably dangerous condition because I found, since Corbin, I've been submitting that additional question to the jury. Did the condition constitute an unreasonably dangerous condition? And the jury, in the cases I've won, has found it was unreasonably dangerous. In the cases I've lost it on the evidence, and I didn't feel that submitting it hurt me. I don't think it's right based on the definition cited at, but I think that if it's retained, and I'm not arguing for it to be retained, but you could retain that and still reverse this case. For the reason that, and here's where the harm is in this charge. This trial court submitted a different case than the one tried by the plaintiff. We tried this case on the negligent activity of Kroger spraying these plants out there, where the jury found it was foreseeable when they found unreasonably dangerous condition. They found it was foreseeable that that would produce some harm. After that finding, there was an improperly submitted question on did they know or should they have known that the specific hazard was on the floor. That's what Corbin says we don't have to prove. We don't have to prove and are not limited to the specific hazard on the floor.
But to be sure I understand, your complaint is not that the judge asked that question separately and specifically, but he should not even have included it in an instruction in an issue that said, is Kroger liable in this case? In other words, the jury should not have been asked to find this issue.
Not as phrased. Now, the judge, what the judge did is force the jury to consider only the specific hazard on the floor where Ms. Keach fell, instead of broadly submitting or submitting a question which would have included our contention in the language of Corbin that Kroger engaged in pattern of conduct, lawful words now, course of conduct, or method of operation, or as we call it in the trial, a negligent activity, which they foresaw and should have foreseen, did foresee, could produce some harm, whether it was this specific harm or not. The only difference between this and as I see it, it's artificial to say if they had been spraying these plants and they'd sprayed this stuff in Ms. Keith's eye, that you submit it one way, but if they spray it and it gets on the floor and they neglect to inspect, they neglect to clean it up, and they spray out there where they know there's liable to be a hazard, you submit it a different way. To me, that's semantics and shouldn't be submitted that way. And if this court should not reverse this case, then I think it's going to send out the message to all the lawyers going into the charge conference and the judges who are sitting in the charge conference that we're stepping back away from broad form submission, that we don't have broad form submission. Justice Phillips asked, if Parker and Corbin and Hernandez could all be correct. I agree they could all be correct. A Rule 277 and this case can't both be correct. Either Rule 277 is right and EB is right, or in this case is wrong, or vice versa. We ask that you reverse this case and remand it for a new trial.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the second call. The court will now take another brief recess.
You may please rise.